You're listening to another cut from Mike Smith's Close Enough for Love. It features Kurt Elling in a couple cuts, but it's mostly Mike doing his horn thing. Go to MikeSmithSaxophone.com. And now that I think about it, and now I have on the phone with me David Hamlin out in California, the author of Winter in Chicago. David, I don't know if you just got a chance to hear that little snippet of music, but that would be a great soundtrack for the beginning of the film version of Winter in Chicago, and I certainly think this book should become a movie. Did you hear it?
I did. I've been actually been listening since you came on the air, and it's delicious saxophone. It's really
don't you think? I mean, if in reading your book, I mean, there's a certain. We will get deeply into Winter in Chicago, which I enjoyed tremendously. On the cover, it says drugs, death, and rock and roll on Chicago's AM radio dial. So I tell you who's listening most intently right now among the thousands of people there is our newsman, Roger Badish, for obvious reasons. I'm going to get him a copy of the book, too. David, your background is fascinating to me. You were a Vista volunteer. You're from D.C., Vista volunteer, cum laude graduate of Nassau College in Maine, which I've never heard of. But you have two careers. You were an executive with the ACLU and then a partner in a Los Angeles public relations and marketing agency, which you co-founded with your wife, who is an old dear friend of mine, Sydney Weissman. How much time did you spend in Chicago? Because if there's one thing about your novel, Winter in Chicago, it has a real sure feel for this city.
Oh, I'm delighted to hear that. I was actually in Chicago twice. I was there in the summer of 1965 training for my Vista service, during which, among other things, I lived in Cabrini Green, which was an eye-opening experience.
I'll bet.
And then I returned to Chicago in 1974 when I became the executive director of ACLU in Illinois. And I was there with ACLU for four and a half years and stayed for another 6 or 7 months before Sydney and I left Chicago and moved to the West Coast.
Well, I am sorry I never got to meet you here, because among many things in your book, among many settings is your book, is an old bar restaurant here called Ricardo's. I'm actually going to read a paragraph about Ricardo's here. Before we get into the book, I want to tell you one of your previous books. You wrote a firsthand account of the Nazi Skokie conflict that I remember well, and I know a lot of listeners remember well. That was published in 1980. How did that book come to be? Were you working for the AC? Go ahead.
As I say, I was ACLU's executive director during that period of time, and when my absolutely extraordinary legal director, David Goldberger, came into my office and said, I have this case involving a demonstration in Skokie, I said, we have to take that case.
Good
so
for you.
I went through, David and I survived 19 months of sustained controversy, and a little while after that, both of us quite exhausted. We left ACLU, and I had an offer to write that book, so I jumped on it.
It was an amazing story, and the book might be, I'm thinking it might be out of print, but I still want to get it because it was a seminal issue in these parts. How did this?
It was a great First Amendment battle, and it continues to have relevance even today.
No question. I just, as an aside, one of the things it did too, which I think was very important, is it brought a lot of Holocaust survivors, many of whom lived in Skokie at the time, out of the shadows. This was a group of people that rarely, if ever, talked about their experiences during World War II and the Holocaust, and after this, they began to talk. And don't you think that's a very important kind of ripple effect that whole to-do had, David Hamlin?
I certainly do. I think the whole process, while it was extremely difficult on both sides,
yep,
and very challenging on both sides, I do think it provided us a sort of firsthand history lesson that might otherwise never have been taught. And I know that my experience was that grandparents and their grandchildren during the Skokie era were passionate and deeply committed to understanding and, frankly, fighting about the issues that were involved.
Yeah, no kidding. So how does a guy who is, comfortably ensconced in California decide to himself, well, I think I'll write a novel? The novel, again, is Winter in Chicago, and it's life, death, drugs, rock and roll, set in 1975. A real sure feel for Chicago and for this crazy business of radio, too. What compelled you to sit down and start this, David?
Well, I had several thoughts in mind all at once. I was and remained, to the extent that it's possible, I loved rock radio on the AM dial when I was growing up. It was exciting. It was phenomenal. It was rich in personalities, some of whom I hope I've tried to capture in the book.
Well, you have one of the hallmarks of the book is it is punctuated with radio bits, as if you're listening to the radio. I'm going to take one from page 101 right now. Just about time for me to leave you, friends, but before I go, I have three in a row for you. Decker played Chantilly Lace, Peggy Sue, and La Bamba without interruption. We miss you all, guys. Our music hasn't been the same since we lost you. So that's it for me today, friends. I'll be back to share the joy with you tomorrow. Until then, as always, I ask you only one thing of you. Shine on, Chicago. That's a very... you have captured it. I mean, you have either great retention or you recorded old DJs or something, David. I like that sort of peppering the book with live broadcast in print.
Well, as I say, I loved the energy and the personality of rock radio on the AM dial, and I've listened from coast to coast for as long as it survived. Some Chicago DJs certainly inspired this work, and I actually believe that the guy who primarily inspired John Decker, who was the disc jockey in my office, I believe I heard him in Philadelphia in the 60s when he was operating under a different name. But there were also there was a DJ in Washington D.C. who played the first Beatle records ever heard in America. I was inspired by him. I particularly like the guys who were not afraid to step outside the format and explore all kinds of music, and I certainly wanted to capture that part of radio in 1975 as well.
Well, I listened to radio then. My friend Roger Badish, who's the newsman, was not quite in radio then, but close. He'll be my real judge for this, but I found it to ring so true of its time, because one of the things that enables you to do in interspersing the book or punctuating the book with broadcast in italics in Winter in Chicago is it really is a very, very cagey way of getting in facts and time and place, don't you think? Didn't you realize that as you were doing it?
Well, it occurred to me that I very much wanted the book to be set precisely when it is. It's a very specific moment in time when the joy of rock and roll on the AM dial was beginning to fade. Consultants were coming in and saying, "We think there's a better way to do this," and I wanted that moment. It was the absolute peak of the feminist movement and the clashes in the professional world over what women's role would be and how they would get it and what they had to fight for. Both of those, it seemed to me, were at their peak in the mid-70s. And so I picked that time specifically. And once I'd done that, it became very clear to me that I had to establish that time in a way which would make sense for people. So I began researching news stories from that era and found a way to plug them into the book so everybody would know exactly where we were and what was going on at the time.
Yeah, I think it's very, very clever. I'm talking to David Hamlin, who's in California, so it's a little earlier out there. His novel, his first novel, is Winter in Chicago. It's got a picture of on the front cover of the Tribune Tower and the Wrigley Building, so you got to love that. And it takes place here in 1975. We'll get into the specifics of that. And also, talking about the whole feminism thing, you do a marvelous job of the heroine of the book is a young woman named Emily who has aspirations to be a TV reporter, as everybody does. But she works in radio, and she gets, just before we take a break, David Hamlin, she's with some sort of crusty old-timers who, they don't abuse her, but they have nicknames for her. You really capture those guys very, very well. So there's a compliment for you. We'll be back in a couple minutes. You'll have more. There are more coming your way. Hold on. Mike Smith's horn taking us back. It's on a CD called Close Enough for Love, but taking us back to what I hope is one day the soundtrack for David Hamlin's first novel, Winter in Chicago. It so evokes, I think, the time. Even though it's a rock and roll radio station we're dealing with most of the time, it really evokes that kind of noirish feel. David, allow me to read one paragraph, if you wouldn't mind. Is that okay?
Sure.
On Friday nights, print and electronic reporters, photographers, freelance writers, radio and TV producers, news anchors, publicists, ad agency creative staff, and ad sales reps all met and drank at Ricardo's Fanciful Bar, an enormous artist's palette turned on its side. Sports writers talked politics, political writers talked sports, print reporters swapped stories, celebrity columnists mingled with beat reporters, movie critics shared drinks with political operatives. Man, did you catch that place, because certainly I was there in 1975. That is where the heroine of this book, Emily, goes. Emily has come upon what some believe to be a suicide, but what she feels is a murder. She becomes, in the course of your novel, David, she becomes a almost a private eye, does she not?
She does. She does. She is an investigative reporter by the time she's done, and the story she's working on is of very little interest to anyone else, but she's determined to find out exactly what happened. And
because the suicide/murder victim is an old friend of hers, or she knows the person.
Is a high school pal of hers, and she finds it very hard to believe, as the police do, that this was a straight-ahead suicide. And so she begins to explore largely on her own time, because her real job is to write the news, not to seek it out and report it. And she encounters both the obstacles which come with uncovering what may be a crime and the obstacles of being a woman in an all-male newsroom in an all-male news business.
Yeah.
Where she is neither accepted nor particularly welcome.
No kidding. I mean, all of a sudden there's some lines at the beginning where the guys are, she's nicknamed Nails at one point. And even some of the cops are it's a misogynistic world into which she travels, is it not?
It is, and she is a, in that regard, she's a composite of dozens of women I knew in that era who were encountering the same kind of misogyny and stress and tension across a variety of professions. I just thought it was particularly virulent and difficult in a profession where everything was changing as fast as people could keep up with it. Journalism, well, radio news at that point was a very big deal.
Oh, yeah, Mike,
it's still true on the station you and I are participating in.
No kidding.
There are an awful lot of AM stations out there that do 35 seconds of news and they're done with it.
Yep.
That all began in the mid-70s when consultants came to the radio business and said, you know, we can squeeze more money out of this and take all the personality out of it. But nobody really cares about news anymore, so let's dump that first.
Well, one of the things you do in the novel, again, the novel which is titled Winter in Chicago, you do have some of these consultants flitting around in the book, too, in an unkind light. If you've just been listening to David talk, these are the guys who kind of ruined this business. You also have a very rich array of, you got a couple of really cool cab drivers. Richard J. Daley is in this book. There's a noir. I don't know if you take that label complimentary or not, but there's a real good, I think, noir feel to this novel, David. You take that as praise?
There's a sense of mystery about it, which I very much wanted to capture. But I also think that the atmosphere in which Emily works was, while it was exciting and it was very clear to me from the beginning of the book that she loves what she's doing.
No question.
She is deeply, deeply dedicated to her profession. She wants to get it right. She knows how to run down the story. But there's an awful lot of stuff that gets in the way as she's trying to do that. And at points, it becomes quite dark and somewhat depressing because what she's doing is hard and no one really wants the story to come out.
Yeah, that's what I found was so compelling is her determination in the face of dozens of people who do not care. It had to be a challenge, but did you enjoy the novel writing process, your first dive into that crazy pool?
I have not had so much fun in about 30 years. it was a genuine treat. I've told folks that I've carried this book around for a very long time. I knew that at some point I wanted to write it. I knew who the character would be. I knew what the basic framework would be. But when I finally had the time and the room to sit down and start writing it, I had no idea it would be this much fun. It was just a joy to write this.
Well, you have succeeded tremendously. The novel is Winter in Chicago. It is set in 1975. It's about, there's politics, there's race, there's sexism, there's feminism, budding feminism, there's murder and or suicide. You be the judge, because your pal Emily is going to go about the business of finding out. There's always something terribly empowering about finishing a novel, not just seeing it between covers and being read. Are you working on another one?
I am working on a sequel to this one, actually.
Fantastic, because this...
The folks who have read this book and talked with me about it and or written reviews about it for Amazon and other sites have pretty much convinced me that they all fell in love with Emily, too.
So me, too.
I'm going to keep working with her until she runs out of steam.
I don't know if this is an endorsement for your next book, Jacket, but I would tell you that, man, do I wish I met Emily at Ricardo's in 1975. I'll tell you that, David. David Hamlin, my new favorite novelist. My love to your dear wife, who I haven't seen in ages, but who remains a dear friend. And I can't wait to read the next one, David. Congratulations.
Thank you, Rick.
My pleasure.
I greatly appreciate the compliments, and it's an honor to be on the air with you.
Well, it was my pleasure to read your book, too. Thank you, and go give your wife a hug. Take care.
I will do that. You have a good evening.
Thank you. You too.